Like the office they commemorate, presidential libraries are living institutions. Certainly, it is my hope that the Reagan Library will become a dynamic intellectual forum where scholars interpret the past and policymakers debate the future.
Welcome to a Reagan Forum, hosted by the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute. The Center for Public Affairs offers lectures and forums presenting perspectives on important public policy issues of the day, from politicians, authors, members of the media, business and military leaders, and more. In this week's Reagan Forum podcast, we go back just a few days to April 4th, 2022, for our in-person event with Supreme Court Associate Justice Amy Coney Barrett. While making remarks to announce his intention to nominate Sandra Day O'Connor to be an Associate Justice, President Reagan said,
"During my campaign for the presidency, I made a commitment that one of my first appointments to the Supreme Court vacancy would be the most qualified woman that I could possibly find. Now, this is not to say that I would appoint a woman merely to do so. That would not be fair to women, nor to future generations of all Americans whose lives are so deeply affected by decisions of the court. Rather, I pledge to appoint a woman who meets the very high standards that I demand of all court appointees. I have identified such a person."
President Trump identified such a person in Amy Coney Barrett, nominating her for her seat on the court in 2020. Previously, Amy Coney Barrett served as a law clerk for Judge Lawrence Silberman of the United States Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit from 1997 to 1998, and for Justice Antonin Scalia of the Supreme Court during the 1998 term. After 2 years in private law practice in Washington, D.C., she became a law professor, joining the faculty of Notre Dame Law School in 2002. She was appointed a judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit in 2017. During the event at the Reagan Library, she sat on stage in conversation with Reagan Foundation Institute Board Chairman Fred Ryan. Let's listen.
Well, thank you for joining us this evening, Justice Barrett. I should say, in terms of full disclosure, although I am a non-practicing lawyer, I am a member in good standing of the Supreme Court Bar. And at least at the beginning of the evening, I am. I hope by the end of the evening, I'll be in the same condition.
I hope concern for that is curbs any questions that you may ask that are out of line.
Well, here we are at the Reagan Presidential Library, and we were thrilled to be able to give the chance for you and to see the library this afternoon. And I was just wondering, if I have done my math right, you were a third grader when Ronald Reagan was elected president, and you were a high school student when he left office. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering if you could share some thoughts on what it was like being a young person and growing up in Ronald Reagan's America.
So I was in third grade in 1980 when Ronald Reagan was elected. And in our third grade classroom, as in many grade schools across the country, every time there's a presidential election, we held a mock election. And Supreme Court justices can't talk about their politics past or present, so I won't tell you what my nine-year-old self, what vote I cast in our mock election. But it's the first election that I have any consciousness of, because I was in school at that point, and we did this election, and I paid some attention to it. And so I would say that in my formative years, or formative years might be the wrong word to use, but as I became conscious somewhat of what was going on in politics, Ronald Reagan was the president. And so in many respects, he shaped my idea of what a president should be, because he was the president that I knew when I first started paying attention.
Terrific. Well, we're so glad that you could see the library and hope you'll return again.
It is wonderful. I'd been told it was a wonderful library and it exceeded expectations. It's really magnificent.
Terrific. Well, the timing of our conversation is unique tonight. I have to imagine that watching another person going through the confirmation process might bring back some memories of your own. I won't ask if you're regretting the chance not to come before the Senate again. But it's a process that so few Americans have been through, and it's such a high-profile process. And I was just wondering, you know, an announcement is made that there's an opening on the court, and then names are circulated, and weeks go by, and then a decision is finally made, and the confirmation begins. I was just wondering if you could share a little bit with us about what it was like for you and your family in that process, and how did you learn that you were... that you've been selected to be the nominee?
So my process was a little bit unique. As you're describing, Fred, it's typical, the vacancy arises and then there are weeks and names are circulating. but mine happened on a compressed time frame. And my husband and I were out to dinner on the Friday night that Justice Ginsburg passed away. And we were with two friends, both of whom happened to be lawyers, enjoying this wonderful meal. And then our phones started going off, and we learned that Justice Ginsburg had passed away. So it was a it's the loss of a great American. Very sad occasion, kind of obviously put a damper on the meal. And we went home, and I had been considered for the vacancy that arose when Justice Kennedy retired in 2018. And we also knew, and the marshals in charge of the Northern District of Indiana and South Bend in particular knew, that regardless of what happened at that point, I was likely to become the object of media scrutiny again. So that weekend, in which I had intended to go to Costco and go to my daughter's soccer game, the marshals advised me not to leave my house just because they weren't exactly sure what would happen, just given the intense scrutiny at the time. And that weekend, I was contacted by the White House counsel and invited to come and interview that week. And it all just happened very quickly. And it didn't give my husband and I a lot of time to make a decision about whether we would be open to it or not. We had discussed it in 2018, but this was, 2 years later, and so, things had changed. So we had kind of a very brass tacks, are we up for this or are we not? And Jesse said, this is an opportunity to serve our country, and if you want to do it, I'm all in, but if we do it, we're burning the boats. And he said, the confirmation process is going to be hard if you're selected, and then if you are confirmed, there will be a lot of hard things that we face about the job, and there just cannot be any looking back. So if you agree on those terms, then I'm in. So that was kind of our mantra, burn the boats, and as things got hard, we'd say, burned the boats, no looking back. And then moved forward.
I heard, I guess it was the previous time your name was floated, I heard a story about the efforts of some people to get a photo of you. And I don't know if you'd be willing to share the links that you went to preserve your privacy.
I will. Fred and I were chatting about this in the green room. So in 2018, when there was a lot of speculation about who would be selected for Justice Kennedy's seat, there was five media trucks that parked outside of my house for days and days on end. And some were very aggressive. As I told Fred, it was not the Washington Post. So one Sunday morning, usually the media trucks would show up around 8. And it was a Sunday morning, and I was going to head to Mass. And so I left the house before I thought they were going to come. And one showed up, and I led them on a chase through the neighborhood because I really didn't want to be followed. Was very proud of myself because I managed to shake them. I was confident. Parked the car at our church, and when I went to go walk in, I saw one of the Suburbans that I recognized from outside of the house coming through the other way. So I spent the whole time, I was telling Fred during the service, plotting how I could escape without giving the media the satisfaction of a picture of me outside of a church. I made an exit out of a side door before it was over that I had never exited before, and it turned out there was a reason for that. It didn't actually exit out, but it rather went into the priest's private residence in the yard. And so I'm standing there, I'm in the yard, and there's a fence, and so I faced a choice. I could either hop the fence, or I could go back out the front and give them this picture. So I decided in my high heels to climb the fence so gracefully. And when I drop down on the other side, I see our associate pastor who says, Amy, what are you doing in our vegetable garden? But he turned out to be a great co-conspirator, and Father Dan helped me make my escape without giving them that picture. So.
Maybe we could talk. You're through the confirmation, you're on the court, and as far as I know, there's not a handbook for new justices or an orientation boot camp. Who helped you learn the ropes during your first year as a justice?
all the justices were so welcoming. You know, on the night that I was confirmed, I honestly, that night was a blur, so I can't remember who called first, but both the Chief Justice and Justice Sotomayor called immediately to extend their congratulations. Justice Sotomayor shared with me her law clerk manual that she used in chambers, and she said it had meant a lot to her when other justices had done that, and all of the justices came by to say hello, had lunch, offered advice. And I would say that starting the job, there is no handbook, and I was starting midterm. I was confirmed, and then there were arguments the following Monday. So I was scrambling. I had to set up at chambers and hire staff and get up and running on the oral arguments, read the briefs. My family was still living in South Bend, so I was commuting back and forth and trying to make quick adjustments to make that happen. So it was a very overwhelming time. And there isn't a manual, but I think I was saying to someone recently that the job is a little bit like parenting, in that you, I think in my case, and I think in many people's cases, you learn how to parent by watching your parents, and not that you imitate everything that they did, right? But it's what you like and what you don't like, and they're the model against which you decide what you're going to do. And so you mentioned that I clerked for Judge Silberman and Justice Scalia. So walking in, I had some idea of, you know, how they ran their chambers, how they interacted with their law clerks, the process that they used to decide cases. And so I had those models to choose from and decide what parts of it I was going to adopt and what parts I might do differently.
Well, you will have a new justice in the court at some point soon. Is there advice you would offer to a new justice?
Let's see. I think it's hard to even know what to say, and I'm sure everybody's experience is so difficult, so different and difficult. I think that a new justice is likely to start in October, and so fortunately there will be some lead time. And in the summer, you know, hopefully there will be an opportunity, you know, to ramp up and do some of those things in advance. I think one of the difficult things that I experienced that I wasn't really fully prepared for was the shift into being a public figure, and also security is much different now than it was when I was clerking on the court. You know, Justice Scalia did not have security. We all have security details, and that's different. And so I have actually thought about what would I say to a new justice and what to brace for. And I think those are some of the things that are hardest.
I came by a quote by you back in your days when you were a clerk at the Supreme Court. It's about the Supreme Court cafeteria. And your quote was, "It was not a place you would choose for a date night." Have you had a chance to improve it since you were alive?
I don't remember saying that, but it certainly is true. It would not be a date night destination, or it would be a very brief relationship if it were. It is tradition of the court that the junior justice serves on the cafeteria committee. And justices who have been my predecessors have given such contributions to the cafeteria as Justice Kagan proudly contributed a Froyo machine. And Justice Kavanaugh notably brought pizza to the cafeteria. Justice Breyer did yeoman's work for 11 years because he was junior justice for the longest stretch in recent times. But I had, you know, I think it's good luck of coming in during COVID when the cafeteria was largely closed. So I didn't really have much opportunity. I never went to a single committee meeting. And I also had the good fortune of coming in. I did have some ideas of what I would want to do. I thought it would be great to have a Starbucks bar. And that was what I was thinking. We're going to have Starbucks coffee because the coffee had not been very good. But it turned out there was a beautiful renovation of the cafeteria that was done right before I began, and we have Starbucks. So come visit our cafeteria. I still would not call it a destination for a date night, but it really is very lovely, and I had nothing to do with it.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about the court as an institution. Although it was not the case for much of the court's long history, today many of the justices have working spouses. You, your husband Jesse remains a practicing lawyer. What do you see as some of the challenges of balancing two careers when one is in service to the Supreme Court?
I think that for us, the challenges that we face are those that, you know, couples who are both working and have children at home always face. I mean, we balance now in the same way that we've balanced for our whole marriage, you know, who's going to do what for childcare and spreading ourselves thin. And Jesse is very generous in picking up a lot of the slack. He is working largely out of a home office right now, and so that gives him a little bit of flexibility, which is much appreciated by me. You know, Jesse is a lawyer, and so we are very careful to avoid conflicts. Not all justices who have working spouses have spouses who are lawyers. The chief does, although his wife is no longer actually practicing law. So it is, it's something that we're very conscious of and very careful about, but, you know, I think we're living in a time when we have a lot of couples where both are working, and so I think that the court and, you know, society has to adjust to expect that.
More from our Reagan Forum with Associate Justice Amy Coney Barrett after this message.
The Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation is the nonprofit organization created by President Reagan himself, and specifically charged by him with continuing his legacy and sharing his principles: individual liberty, economic opportunity, global democracy, and national pride. We must remain vigilant and work together to share these conservative principles with younger generations. Your role is critical to move our mission forward. Thank you for your continued support. Please visit reaganfoundation.org/give. That's reaganfoundation.org/give.
Now back to our Reagan Forum with Associate Justice Amy Coney Barrett.
Do you think there should be court guidelines on what working spouses should and should not do?
I don't think most of the spouses would be very happy about those guidelines. Certainly when I try to give my husband guidelines about what to do and not to do in the house, even, that doesn't go over very well. No, I mean, the court is very, like I said, everybody's very attentive to those kinds of things, so.
One thing that a lot of people think about the Supreme Court is that in order to be a justice, you have to have either been a judge or even be a lawyer, but that's not the case. Do you think it should be a requirement to be a lawyer to be on the Supreme Court, or is there another profession that would prepare people well for that?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, it's not a constitutional requirement, you know, that you have to be a lawyer. It's very difficult for me to imagine someone being able to serve successfully on the Supreme Court without being a lawyer and having some familiarity with the law. Interestingly, though, it's only in more recent times that everyone who has served on the Supreme Court has had a degree from a law school. And Justice Robert Jackson, who is, you know, one of the most notable Supreme Court justices, was the last justice to serve on the court having earned his law degree through an apprenticeship. He didn't actually have a degree from a law school. I think it's certainly not the case that all Supreme Court justices had to have served as judges first. Elena Kagan, my colleague, was not a judge before joining the Supreme Court. She'd been the dean of Harvard Law School. She'd been Solicitor General of the United States, but she had not been a judge. You know, Chief Justice Taft had been president of the United States before joining the Supreme Court. So many different professional backgrounds, I think, could do the job, but it's really difficult for me to see how someone who wasn't a lawyer could dive in.
You mentioned the law schools, and you are the only justice on the court at the moment who didn't go to either Harvard or Yale. I know you've said you could teach the others a little bit about football, but do you think that, what are your thoughts on the diversity of schools represented, and what should it be going forward?
I think diversity in every respect is good, including in background of education. I think people choose law schools for all different reasons. I mean, I chose Notre Dame because I was attracted to it as an institution. I also had a full scholarship, and I didn't know what I was going to do after law school and didn't want to be required to go to a large law firm to pay off debt. And so, you know, I think it's very valuable to allow people to feel like they can make many different choices and receive great educations at other institutions besides Harvard and Yale without taking themselves out of the running to pursue certain professional opportunities.
Term limits are something that's discussed from time to time about federal judges. The younger judges seem to favor term limits, but the older judges seem to not favor term limits. Do you have a view on whether there should be term limits?
Well, I mean, I think Congress has a lot of control over shaping the federal courts generally, it possesses that by virtue of the Constitution. You know, there was recently a commission that President Biden formed to study the Supreme Court, and some members of that commission favored term limits. There was a vigorous debate about it, whether they would be constitutional. And it is a question of public policy on which there's a debate about the constitutionality of it, so I can't express an opinion about it. I feel like I'm at a confirmation hearing. You know, I can't say one way or the other.
Hey, those guys are 20 years older than I am.
But I do, I mean, I do think that the conversation, you know, that the Supreme Court Commission had about it is an interesting one. If people are interested in some of the pros and cons, I refer you to that.
Do you have a view on how long someone should stay on the court?
No, I think it's a very personal decision. I think it really depends. I mean, people, you know, people have, people age differently. You know, Justice Ginsburg used to say as long as she could do the job and do it well, and, you know, I think that's the philosophy that many have about their working lives generally. So I think that's a personal decision that each justice makes for him or herself.
Sure. When you compare the court to the executive branch and the legislative branch, the Supreme Court seems to be shrouded maybe in a little bit more mystery. For example, the hearings are only more recently have been audio. First they were delayed audio, and then now they're real audio. Do you have a view on whether there should be some type of a stationary camera there so people can see what's happening in the court?
So the idea of the idea of having cameras in the Supreme Court is one that comes up a lot, you know, and I was asked about it at my confirmation hearing, and it's certainly not something that any one justice has the authority to decide. I mean, that would be something that was decided by consensus, or I assume maybe the chief could do that on his own. But I think, you know, because it's the kind of thing that I can't do unilaterally and would be a matter of internal deliberation, I won't express an opinion on it, but one thing that I would throw out, I mean, I think when people imagine cameras in the courtroom, they imagine a fly on the wall. And so you imagine being able to have a camera that nobody can see that's there, that's just a window into what's happening in the court. But I guess I would say, in thinking about all of the pros and cons of cameras in the courtroom, one thing to think about is that, you know, people don't behave the same when they know that there's a camera there that they do than they do if there's a camera not. And so if what we want is to allow the American people to see what is happening in the court, in many ways, the audio, you don't need to see our faces. In many ways, the audio really gives that window, whereas the camera would risk, I think, changing the nature of the proceedings. And that's not to say that, you know, maybe that trade-off is worth it, but I don't think that piece of the trade-off gets focused on as much. And I think as institutions go, I think, Fred, you're right that the court is shrouded in some secrecy because internal deliberations, you know, happen privately rather than in debate on the floor, say like in Congress, although they happen privately in, you know, the executive branch and in some parts of Congress's work as well. But we're very transparent with respect to our reasoning, our decisions, our opinions are published, and all of our reasoning is laid bare. And the courtroom is open to the public in non-COVID times. We're still closed to the public right now because of the pandemic. So we do want the American people to see our work, and we try to show our work. I think cameras is just a uniquely tricky issue.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of opinions, this term the court will likely issue opinions on some high-profile emotional subjects that, regardless of how they're decided, there will be a certain segment of people who are disappointed and maybe even angry. When we live in a time where institutions are always under attack and being diminished, how does the court preserve the integrity of the institution and retain the respect and dignity that it deserves?
So I think that writing the opinions, and I think I would urge all engaged and interested Americans to read the opinions. I know that, speaking for myself, and I've heard several of my colleagues say, as well as colleagues on the lower courts, that when they write opinions, they try to write them in a manner that would be accessible to informed Americans. And I think, you know, when Congress enacts a law or something that's driven by policy, you just have the bottom line. Yes, cameras in the courtroom, or, you know, pick your topic of the day. There's no explanation or reasoning behind it because it's just the result that matters. But that's not how the court works. It's not just the result that matters. And I think that you can disagree with the result passionately. I used to tell this to my students in constitutional law. You know, I would ask them on the first day, I would give them a couple of the court's big cases, like Citizens United or Heller, which was a Second Amendment case, or Roe versus Wade. And I would ask for a show of hands on who thought the court was right or who thought the court was wrong with respect to each of those cases. And you know, you'd get shows of hands and people felt passionately. But then if I asked who, and these were first year law students, but if I asked who had read those decisions, there weren't a lot of hands going up. And in their defense, you know, they had not yet been assigned in class, so that wasn't a comment, it was the first day of class. But I think it's one thing, and certainly I, you know, even serving on the court, have opinions about the results of decisions, but justices aren't deciding cases. No judge is deciding a case in order to impose a policy result. They're trying to make their best effort to determine what the law requires, what the Constitution requires, what statutes require. And so I guess I would say that it's perfectly fair game to say that you dislike the results of a case. And it's also perfectly fair game to say that the court got it wrong. But I think if you're going to make the latter claim that the court got it wrong, you have to engage with the court's reasoning first. And I think you should read the opinion and see, well, does this read like something that was purely results-driven and designed to impose the policy preferences of the majority? Or does this read like it actually is an honest effort, a persuasive effort, even if one you ultimately don't agree with, to determine what the Constitution and precedent requires, you know, as applied to a particular problem at hand?
Somewhat related to that, I know you've spoken out about concerns that the court not be viewed as a partisan body. Mm-hmm. What can the court do to correct this perception?
Well, I think the opinion writing process actually, I think, is part of it. I mean, I think the court, and I'm saying the court, but what I'm saying is actually equally applicable to all federal courts, is accountable in its reasoning. I think this is the standard by which the American people should judge the court. Is the court laying out its reasoning? Is its reasoning that of a political or legislative body, or is its reasoning judicial? Is its reasoning from all of the traditional tools that inform our body of precedent, you know, prior cases, statutes, the Constitution itself? So I think that's a big part of it. I also think that the way that justices write opinions in measured tones, I think, is important. And I think the way that justices talk about the court and relate to one another, the court truly is very collegial. And even when we disagree with one another about the results of a case, how a case should be decided, the reasoning of a case, you know, we always, I've been honored to be part of the institution, and I have been really grateful for the tremendous collegiality and respect that the court shows, members of the court show for one another. And I think Americans would all be better off if we all showed that level of respect, even for those with whom we disagree. Mm-hmm.
And Justin, while we're talking about areas where we disagree, there's a growing concern about intolerance for free speech on America's universities and even law school campuses. What do these incidents say about the health of our democracy? And what advice would you give students who may passionately disagree with viewpoints they hear on campus?
I'm a passionate defender of the First Amendment. And you know, the First Amendment applies to public universities. It does not apply to private universities. But I will just talk about the values of free speech broadly, you know, as applicable to both institutions. You know, the reason why we have a First Amendment, the reason why we have free speech, is to protect unpopular speech, because popular speech doesn't need the protection. And I think that for our democracy to thrive, I think for educational institutions to thrive, everything has to be on the table, including protest. I mean, I think there's a place for protest. I think that people need to be able to disagree. People need to be able to express ideas. I think what can't happen, especially in academic institutions, is for any ideas to be pushed off the table. I think you have to engage with those ideas, show why those ideas are wrong. But I think, you know, it's a really fine line between opening students' eyes to the full range of our lived experience as Americans, to the full range of the opinions that they will encounter in the world, you know, as engaged Americans, and protecting each other's feelings. And to be clear, I do think that, you know, we do need to protect one another's feelings. And I just spoke a moment ago about civility and discourse. And so I think that's actually one way to foster free speech, is to try to foster civil discourse in which people are able to express their views in a way that is not threatening or hostile to another side. But I really think, you know, especially for law schools, you're training lawyers who are supposed to be engaged in debate. And so to shield lawyers from any kind of debate, shield budding lawyers from any kind of debate, I don't think, you know, as a law professor to my bones, I think is not a good model for education.
Yes. Well, as a former professor, I know I've heard you may be writing a book. I was wondering if there's anything you could tell us that would inspire you and what the book might be about.
Sure. So, you know, the meat of the book is my project for the summer, once the term is at an end. But I decided to write the book really because I was a professor. I loved teaching, and it's something that I continue to do. I haven't given it up. I'm still teaching a class at Notre Dame. I think that, as some of the questions that you've been asking me tonight, Fred, reflect, I think people are interested in the court, and I think the court is an important institution to our republic and to our way of life. And I think educating Americans or offering a window into the court for Americans is a valuable service. I think more people should understand what the court does. You know, after my confirmation hearings, I got a lot of questions from friends, including faculty members and other departments outside of the law school at Notre Dame, and engaged, educated people that reflected that there's a lot that people don't know about the court, even though they generally follow things. Like, you know, many people thought that the court could just decide whatever cases it wanted, like, you know, wake up one day and say, hey, I think I'll take on, you know, the constitutionality of gay marriage. You know, and that's not how it works at all. You know, you have the court waits until cases come to it. So on a number of different items like that, I felt like, wow, many of the letters that I got from people around the world, questions from people I knew, showed that there was a hunger to know more about the institution that is the Supreme Court.
We hope you'll come back on your book tour and talk about it. One thing I think a lot of people don't know about the Supreme Court, but I was fortunate enough to have had a tour by one of your colleagues, and they're very proud to show you that above the court chambers is a basketball court, which they describe as the highest court in the land. Have you had a chance to shoot some baskets there, or do you have something else you do for your exercise routine?
As my children who have played horse with me will attest, I'm not a very good shot. So I have not thrown baskets myself up at the court, but yes, I've been up to the highest court in the land many times, and it is always a highlight of everyone's tour. My children have gotten to play basketball on the court.
You're currently the youngest person on the court, and this institution will certainly evolve on the years that you're on the bench. Mm-hmm. If you were to come back here many years from now, where would you hope to see the court evolve? What would you like it to look like then?
Let's see. It's hard. That's a very hard question to answer. I guess I would hope that in some ways it didn't evolve too much. I think, as I mentioned before, the court is a very collegial place. I hope that doesn't change. The members of the court are engaged, even though, you know, we have different judicial philosophies and may reach different conclusions. The members of the court are all engaged in an earnest and sincere and serious effort to do their best by the Constitution and by the American people, and I hope that doesn't change. The court is growing increasingly diverse and including people from all walks of life, and I hope that doesn't change. I hope that continues. You know, the court is an institution that has inspired growing democracies in other parts of the world. I taught a class in constitutional law, a small seminar in which some of the LLM students from other countries that Notre Dame took, and they were always interested in the court and how the court in our country, which was a different experience than some of them had, had gained respect, and how the political branches abided by the decisions, you know, that the court had made. And really, that tradition goes back to the beginning of the Republic and to the leadership of John Marshall, and that hasn't changed. The court has managed to maintain its position of respect in the country throughout its existence. So I think, were I to come back, you know, towards the end of my career, I think at the end of the day, I would say that I hoped there were fewer things that changed than that did change about the court.
Well, one thing that you encountered during your arrival on the court, unlike any other justice, was during the pandemic. And the limitations that COVID placed. How do you think the pandemic affected the court? And as we all try to figure out what the world will be like after the pandemic, do you have any thoughts on how the court might be?
So the pandemic, I will say that one very, very thin, small silver lining for me was that I do think it made my transition into the court a little bit easier because, you know, I was commuting back and forth and arguments were remote. And I think that the format, the court during COVID used a different argument format than it does normally, where we went seriatim, one justice after the other, each was allocated a certain number of minutes for questioning. And that was actually an easy way for a new justice to start because I didn't have to come in fighting for floor time and worrying about stepping on a senior colleague's toes by being too aggressive or speaking over them. Or at the other side of the spectrum, not being aggressive enough and not getting my questions asked. And I think one thing that the court has now changed, now that we're back on the bench, that we learned from the COVID experience, is that that style of questioning wasn't one that we retained, but we did like the opportunity to not have as much talking over each other and to feel like everyone got their opportunity to have questions answered. And so we have adopted a new format that allows for more of that, which I think, even though it does make arguments longer, has largely, I think, been welcomed as an improvement. I look forward to the day when the court can be open to the public again so that people can come in and see the court and the public can return to the courtroom for oral argument. I hope that we have much less pandemic law coming before us.
Right.
But I think, you know, it really remains to be seen. I'm sure there will be many sociology dissertations written in years to come about the effects that the pandemic has had on all of us.
Now that life is a little more normal for justices, could you tell us a little bit about how you balance a day in your life is like with the court, with family, your faith, how you balance all of this?
So in some ways, you know, when my oldest daughter, Emma, was born, my husband and I were continually engaged in conversations, mostly initiated by me, like, I just don't know if I can keep working, I don't know if I'm giving her the attention she needs. And we always worked it out, and it was always a lot to juggle, but it kept working out, and the kids were thriving, and Jesse would often tell me, he's like, I think the kids might be better off by having not, you know, having you work and having you be, you know, engaged in all those other things too, because you were around a lot and it enabled him, my working freed him to be, he was an assistant United States attorney for many years prosecuting. And so our being a two-income family and Jesse really wanted to be an AUSA and so he could coach their soccer games. And we lived in a town that was small enough that we could both be back and forth at their schools quickly. So now we're in Washington and the commute's not so great. And it's getting worse now that the pandemic is thankfully coming to an end. Unfortunately, that means cars are back on the road. So we're navigating more because I can't just get home as quickly during the day as I used to be. So, you know, it's a long day. I often pray that my time will be multiplied like the loaves and the fishes. I get up early. I get up usually about 5. And, you know, I try to work and exercise. We get the kids off to school in the morning. You know, work, come back. There's homework. There's soccer. There's lacrosse. Getting everybody where they need to go. Getting dinner ready. Personal email often falls by the wayside, I'm sorry to say, so I'm not a very good communicator. I take a long time to get back to people. But it's a very full life, but our kids have been troopers in the move and they've adjusted really well. I have the good fortune of having a wonderful husband who does more than his share of the work at home. He's been doing all of our cooking and, you know, that's great. So we have a very full life, but wouldn't trade it.
You talk about getting away from Washington, and that was one thing. President Reagan was very keen on making sure that he got away from Washington. In fact, he had ranches, various ranches, in fact, one not far from the library and then one in Santa Barbara. Do you have a place or thing you try to do just to get away from Washington and escape that environment?
Sadly. No, I was about to say, sadly, I've just trumpeted all of the joys of our family. And I was about to say, sadly, you know, we're in the cuffs of we can't leave on the weekends because we have soccer and lacrosse and birthday parties to go to. So, no, we can't really, we can't leave very often because we do have so many kids' activities. Sometimes people ask, you know, or you know, what did you do for fun? Or what did you do this weekend? Did you get to relax? And usually it was about like four different sporting events and a piano recital. So I look forward to the day when maybe we can get some respite over the weekends. Although, you know, we do look forward this summer. We'll spend some time away from Washington and that will be welcome.
A couple of final questions, if I could. One, just how being a justice has changed your relationship with people. You mentioned that it takes a little longer to hear back on emails, but do your friends call you Amy still or Justice Barrett? Does it help adjudicating differences among your children, being a Supreme Court justice?
If my children were impressed at all by the fact that I was a Supreme Court justice, maybe it would help in adjudicating their disputes. One thing that I love about being back in South Bend in Indiana is that I am just Amy. And that was one of the hard things about leaving because I prefer to be just Amy. And so my husband and I, and several of our children, you know, we had a gym that we've worked out. It was a small CrossFit gym. And I felt perfectly comfortable all last year while I was commuting, going back and continuing to work out with everyone there, not worrying that it would be posted on Twitter. Because I was just Amy to our friends there. And so I really particularly treasure these days my longstanding and old friendships for the people to whom I am just Amy. It is a little bit harder to make new friends. You know, when my older girls were young, I was the room mother and I was very involved in the school that they attended. And it's a little bit harder to be that way now. In this fall, I was chasing around our youngest son, who has Down syndrome, at a fundraiser, just an outdoor fair for the school that our youngest daughter is attending. And I'm chasing after him. None of the other family was there. Jesse wasn't there. And a very sweet mom at the school came up to me and said, I just thought I'd introduce myself to you because I bet a lot of people don't talk to you. Which was true, and it's not out of hostility. I think people probably just feel a little bit weird, even when, you know, I have my hair in a ponytail and I'm chasing a child around the playground. So there is a different barrier to relationships and, you know, and making new friendships, you know, than there has been at other parts of my life.
Well, as you saw when you visited the library this afternoon, one thing that was very important to President Reagan was it to be about the future, not about the past, but about the future and inspiring future generations. And I, looking around this room, there are a number of young lawyers and future lawyers here. And I would wonder, is there anything that you would say about how you would like your work and your life to be an inspiration for future generations?
I don't think I've thought about my life in that grandiose a way to say that I want to be an inspiration to future generations. But when I think about what future generations could contribute to the law and to the country and to the legal profession, I think what comes to my mind is, first, civility. Lawyers, you know, it can be pejorative when people find out you're a lawyer and you know, they think that you want to argue and nitpick. I think lawyers have a real opportunity to show how one can disagree and debate with another person without having it devolve into being ugly. I think lawyers have a role in being able to elevate the civility of debate and collegiality. I think that We as a country have to maintain respect for the rule of law and not become cynical and think that there is nothing to the rule of law. And so I would say to aspiring lawyers, you know, please do that. Please don't be cynical about the law. Please take the law seriously and study the law seriously. And then take civic education. Take civic education seriously. I think even in social situations, even when you're at cocktail parties and you're talking about the law, talking about things that the Supreme Court has done, talking about decisions, talking about it in an intelligent way that respects the rule of law and shows how people can debate and disagree without having it disintegrate relationships, I think is a contribution that I hope lawyers will make in the future.
That's great advice for all of us, even older lawyers. Thank you. Thank you for making time to be here. You've been a great sport and a great conversation, and we're delighted you're here, and we hope you'll return many times and often.
Thank you, Fred. Right. Thank you all coming.
Over the past 10 to 15 years, the Reagan Foundation has been beyond fortunate to host a handful of other Supreme Court justices, including Chief Justice John Roberts Jr., Samuel Alito Jr., Anthony Kennedy, and Sandra Day O'Connor. Most recently, we hosted Justice Gorsuch in 2019, and we also held an all-day conference in Washington, D.C. in 2019, honoring the 38th anniversary of Justice O'Connor's Senate confirmation. During that event, Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Sonia Sotomayor joined us on a panel. Many of these events can be found on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/Reagan Foundation. Thank you for listening.
For more information on the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute, including information on how to become a member, information on upcoming exhibits at the Reagan Library, and more information on the legacy of President Reagan, please visit reaganfoundation.org. And don't forget to like and follow the Reagan Foundation on all social media platforms.
Until next week, thanks for listening. God bless you.
Don't forget to subscribe to A Reagan Forum podcast in your iTunes or Google Play stores and on other podcast platforms as they become available. New episodes of A Reagan Forum come out every Thursday. Like what you hear? Check out our Words to Live By podcast, featuring radio addresses and speeches Ronald Reagan delivered from the 1960s through the 1980s. New episodes drop every Tuesday. And don't forget to follow at Ronald Reagan on Facebook, at Ronald Reagan on Twitter, and Reagan Foundation on YouTube. Also, search for us on SoundCloud and Stitcher.